Hey everyone, today is Saturday, January the 8th, 2022, and you're listening to Listen to L Boogie. I'm going to call this season number 4 since it's the beginning of the year. I'm going to wipe the slate clean from last year in that season, in season 3, and begin with season 4. This is the first episode of season 4 of Listen to L Boogie. And in this episode, we're going to cover the sentencing of the two clowns, the three clowns that is, that hunted down and shot Aubrey Miller. We're also going to cover some remarks by the Ethiopian prime minister that weren't favoring two African Americans. He made these comments in a speech to some young people in their country. And maybe one other topic. So I'm glad. I hope everyone is having a good new year so far. I hope everyone, you know, is in good health and in mental state, which that matters more than anything that you got for Christmas. So after this brief message, we're going to be back. And we're going to go ahead on and get busy for 2022. See y'all in a second. Peace. Hi, everyone. You're back on with Listen to L Boogie. I need to make a correction. The name of the brother that was murdered in Georgia is Ahmaud Arbery, not Aubrey Miller. I stand corrected on that. With that being said, we're going to jump right into this first bit of news. All right. Greg Travis McMichael sentenced to life without parole. This is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Greg and Travis McMichael were sentenced Friday to life in prison without the possibility of parole for Ahmaud Arbery's murder, bringing an end to his grief-stricken family's quest for justice that lasted nearly 2 years. William Roddy Bryan, who filmed the cell phone video of Aubrey falling dead in the street, was given life in prison with the possibility of parole. That's the clown that filmed it. Okay. Before sentencing the men, Judge Timothy Wimsley called the killing a tragedy of many, many levels, on many, many levels. A young man with dreams was gunned down in this community, he said, of Aubrey. As we understand it, he left his home apparently to go for a run and ended up running for his life. The judge then sat silently for 1 minute, which he said represented a fraction of the time that Aubrey spent fleeing the three white men as they chased him through Sestalia Shores in pickup trucks on that Sunday afternoon. When reaching his decision, Wimsley said he focused on the terror that Aubrey must have felt that day. Ahmaud Arbery was then hunted down and shot, Wimsley said. And he was killed because individuals here in this courtroom took the law into their own hands. As the men were sentenced, supporters of Aubrey's family celebrated outside the courthouse. Chants of justice for Ahmaud could be heard from the second floor hallway. Please return to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution updates. Well, this is in what I'm reading. Ahmaud Arbery's mother wept in the court Friday morning as she asked the judge to give the men convicted of her son's murder the stiffest sentence possible, life in prison without the possibility of parole. Wanda Cooper Jones began her victim impact statement by addressing her slain son, who was chased down and shot nearly 2 years ago. She called raising him the horror of my life, and said she vowed to get justice for him at his funeral. Son, I love you as much today as I did the day you were born, Cooper Jones said before turning her attention to Judge Timothy Wimsley. They chose to target my son because they didn't want him in their community. Excuse me, she said. When they couldn't sufficiently scare him or intimidate him, they killed him. Travis McMichael, who killed Aubrey with 2 shotgun blasts, his father Greg McMichael, a former police officer and investigator with the local district attorney's office, and their neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, were convicted of murder and other charges the day before Thanksgiving. Each man faces a minimum sentence of life in prison, but Wimsley will decide whether to punishment will come with or without the possibility of parole. Travis McMichael is 35, his father is 66, and Brian is 52. Lead prosecutor Linda Dunkowski asked Wimsley to deny the McMichaels the possibility of parole. For Brian, the state is seeking life in prison with the chance of parole followed by 15 years on probation. Aubrey, 25, was unarmed when he was chased through the Stella Shores subdivision just outside Brunswick by the 3 white men in a pickup truck. He was shot and killed by Travis McMichael during the struggle over the 12-gauge shotgun in the road. Okay. The killing captured on Brian's cell phone galvanized the coastal community of Georgia and helped spark the reckoning of racial justice that swept through the United States in 2020. The cell phone footage released Wednesday before George Floyd's murder also proved to be a crucial piece of evidence at the state trial. Marcus Aubrey Ahmad's father said the man killed his son while he was out doing what he loved most, running. That's when he felt most alive, most free, and they took all of that from him, Marcus Aubrey said. He also noted that Greg and Travis McMichael sat next to each other each day of the trial, something he'll never get a chance to do with his own son. The man who killed my son has sat in this courtroom every single day next to his father. I'll never have that chance ever to sit next to my son ever again, he said. Not at the dinner table, not at a holiday, and not at a wedding. Jasmine Aubrey, Ahmad's sister, also addressed the court. She didn't mince words when she said she believed race played a role in the deadly shooting. Ahmad had dark skin that glistened in the sunlight like gold. He had thick, coily hair, and he would often like to twist it, she said. He was tall with an athletic build. He enjoyed running and had an appreciation for being outdoors. These are the qualities that made these men think Ahmad was a dangerous criminal. Jasmine Aubrey, who, like her mother, broke down while dressing the court, said her brother's killing devastated their family and robbed Ahmad of his life's pleasure, both big and small. His life pleasures, both big and small. So I'm asking the men who killed him be given the maximum sentence available to the court, she said. Wanda Cooper Jones said her son never said a word to his killers, never threatened them, and simply wanted to be left alone. During her remarks, she also referenced to comments about her son's long, dirty toenails made by Greg McMichael's attorneys during her closing argument. He was messy. He sometimes refused to wear socks, she said as tears streamed down her face. I wish he would have cut and cleaned his toenails before he went out that day. I guess he would have if he knew he would have been murdered. Attorney Bob Rubin, who represents Travis McMichael, asked the judge for leniency. All three men will serve a minimum of 30 years behind bars, but Rubin said his clients should one day be eligible for parole. He said life in prison without the possibility of parole should be reserved for those who deserve it, the criminals who are the worst of the worst. This is not a case in which he just targeted someone recklessly, Robin said. This was not a planned murder. This was not torture. It was a fight over a gun that resulted in Mr. Aubrey's death. He noted that Travis McMichael has a young son and will be well into his 60s before he's even eligible for parole. Brian and the McMichaels also face federal hate crime charges in a separate trial set to begin next month. Shortly before today's sentencing hearing, Lee Merritt, an attorney for the Aubrey family, said federal prosecutors had approached the McMichaels to try and work out a plea deal and avoid the trial, but the Aubrey family rejected it, Merritt said. These men were prepared to enter a plea and admit that hate was a motivating factor, he said. Ultimately, we rejected the deal, but I think that was strong evidence that hate was in the fact behind their actions. Okay. Well, Dash is gonna sit in jail, excuse me, and rot. And that's what they deserve. I think that the death sentence should be used in extreme cases. I mean, this is an extreme case, but I believe that they'll be punished more by sitting in jail knowing that their asses will never get out, ever, 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 and that they're going to fucking die in prison. Good for them. It's also to send a message to the rest of you clowns. This is not the fucking 50s and 40s, where you could just snatch up black people at will and do whatever you will. This sends a message that if you pull some bullshit like this, your ass is going to jail. And that's all I have to say about that. I'll be covering my next bit of news concerning some disparaging remarks that the Prime Minister of Ethiopia made in 2019 about African Americans. See you guys in a second. Peace. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, you're back on with Listen to El Boogie. I'm gonna read to you guys some of the comments that Ethiopian Prime Minister made in 2019 about African Americans and Jews. The contrast he made between both groups. Okay. And his name is his first name is A-B-I-Y. His last name is A-H-M-E-D, Hamid. So, Abia, I guess, that's maybe close to the correct pronunciation of his name, but I'm just gonna call him Hamid. He won. Okay. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. Okay. Okay. These are remarks. His remarks. Okay. I probably won't read them all, but I'm going to give you a good dose of what he said. 70 to 80 years ago, the United States, two groups of people were discriminated against, the Jews and the blacks. The Jewish people used to be tortured, imprisoned, and denied jobs. Blacks faced the same fate. You know, the Germans killed the Jews, and many of those who suffered fled to America. Israel did not exist then, and they, the Jews, were scattered all over the world. The Jews made a decision as a people. They said, yesterday we were tortured, oppressed, and discriminated against. If we merely continue to talk about the past, we won't go far enough. We need to have a winning vision so that we will be equipped with better knowledge and wealth than the whites who have been victimizing us and then ruled us. On the other hand, the blacks continue to sing and complain about being oppressed and tortured, saying the whites did this and that to us. To this day, they, the blacks, have not gotten anywhere. What about the other guys, the Jews? The media belongs to them. The banks belong to them. Everything belongs to them. While sitting there in the U.S., they, the Jews, protect and support the small country, Israel. Every policy of the United States on Arab countries, the Middle East, is entirely decided by the Jews because they have so much power. The premier also made similar comments in Aramaic when he spoke to a group of artists in Ababa. Okay. The difference is after the civil rights movement, the songs, poems, films, and dreams of Jews became forward-looking. They became about conquering the world and economic power. Blacks, on the other hand, simply lamented about their history of torture, murder, and so on. Audience smiled and chuckled, making the current generation of blacks to live in the past, while the Jews made their people live for tomorrow. Less than 50 years later, Jews became prosperous and powerful, while blacks became freed poor. They are granted freedom, free to sing, but unable to get out of poverty. Leaving aside Adi's employment of anti-Semitic throps, did American Jews really develop by looking to their future and forgetting their past? Have African Americans victimized themselves by perpetuating their own underdevelopment through focusing on their past victimization, as the Prime Minister claimed? To understand the relevance of his argument, one needs to understand the Ethiopian Empire State that led to his history, to a history of colonization, slavery, terrorism, genocide, and racism against who the Amaro and others are struggling while narrating their past and present victimization. In his speech, the Prime Minister implicitly discredited the narrative of these colonized and victimized groups in order to rationalize and legitimize the crimes of the Ethiopian government through inventing a false narrative about African Americans being discriminated against in their own home countries. Jews began immigrating to the U.S. in the mid-17th century. The first group of Jews came from Brazil and settled in New Amsterdam, which is New York, in 1654. Most of these Jews were merchants and established businesses in American colonial ports such as New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, and Savannah. In addition, in the 1840s, German Jews responded to social upheaval, began immigrating to the U.S. in significant numbers, and at the beginning of World War I, their numbers reached 250,000. After 1880, pushed out by overpopulation, oppressive systems, and poverty, Eastern European Jews started to immigrate to the U.S. Between 1880 and 1924, more than 2 million Jews were from locations including Australia, Hungary, Imperial Russia, and Romania arrived and settled in the U.S. overall, since they were not enslaved in this country, American Jews were able to maintain their history, culture, language, psychology, identity, and religion, which have been the foundation of their survival as a people, as well as the engines of their social culture, economics, and political development. Okay? Excuse me. In contrast, beginning in 1619, the ancestors of the African Americans were merchandised by European slavers and their African collaborators and forcibly brought to the 13 colonies that later became the United States overall. Between early 17th and the last decade of the 19th century, European slave traders and their African collaborators sold and transported between 13 and 15 million Africans to the Americas. African descended slaves lived under bondage and terror until 1863 African descended slaves lived under bondage and terror until then it has between 1863 and 1865, when the system was defeated in the process of the American Civil War. Black people in America were stripped of their identity, culture, history, language, names, religion, and forced to take those of Anglo-Americans doing racial slavery. After the legal abolition of racial slavery, racial oppression and exploitation continued by another name, segregation or Jim Crow laws, until the mid-1960s. These injustices were enforced by U.S. governments, primarily groups such as White Citizens Council, the American States Rights Association, the National Association for the Advancement of White People, the Ku Klux Klan, as well as white society, practiced torture and lynching, which were forms of terrorism. These criminal acts were committed to maintain a racial hierarchy and white privilege. During racial slavery and segregation, millions of African Americans were not allowed to use the fruits of their labor to accumulate wealth, but were forced to enrich the white capitalist class and white society, which emerged as a hegemonic world power in the mid-20th century. They suffered in the belly of the beast while acting as its backbone and helping to make it the richest and most powerful country in the world. They helped build the country through suffering, deprivation, and by working day and night. The system of racial slavery, which was an ultimate denial of human freedom and racial segregation, African Americans were forced to enrich white slave owners and later white society, and contributed to the development of the U.S. for almost 3.5 centuries. In contrast, American Jews arrived in the U.S. as business people and free workers. In this way, they maintained control of their wealth and labor, despite the fact that they were discriminated against because of their religion and ethnic identity. American Jews were allowed to achieve generational and intergenerational upward mobility by culturally and structurally assimilating into white society through open access to political and economic opportunities, because they were not slaves and they were not black. They never faced racial segregation like African Americans in this country. Formal racial segregation continued in the U.S., mainly in the South, through the 1960s. White establishment and society excluded most African Americans from the culture, political, and economic resources of the country. During racial segregation, African Americans were terrorized and lynched by terrorist organizations such as the KKK, which were allowed by the U.S. federal, state, and local governments to dehumanize and kill black Americans in order to maintain a racial hierarchy and white privilege. This situation began to shift when African Americans engaged in the civil rights movement and the black liberation struggle to change their deplorable conditions. Collective grievances and racial slavery and segregation, migration from rural to urban areas, community and institutional building, and the emergence of black intellectuals and organizations during the first half of the 20th century mobilized black people to resist oppression and to collectively struggle for their cultural identity, civil rights, and total transformation of U.S. society so they could achieve true equality. They also struggled to transform American apartheid democracy to multicultural democracy. Hamed, because of his ignorance or political opportunism, scoffed at these acts of endurance, defiance, courage, and ultimately liberation. He claimed that African American nationalism has perpetuated the suffering of black society, when in fact this nationalism has empowered them to become the process of dismantling U.S. racial discrimination, which denied blacks equal access to political, cultural, economic, and social opportunities within the U.S. society. In reality, black nationalism and the struggle of African Americans resulted in the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and subsequent laws. These laws were great achievements of black struggle and empowerment. Realizing that the laws did not changed the condition of the black masses, the revolutionary element of the black community, struggled to develop the entire community, which was not acceptable to the white establishment. Then U.S. government started to use a double-edged policy. First, the white establishment allowed the integration of reformist black elites into white institutions by providing them some access to economic and political opportunities. Second, the white establishment engaged in the repression of black revolutionary entities and the black masses through violence and imprisonment. During the first period, revolutionary leaders such as the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X were assassinated. The former was assassinated in 1968 and the latter in 1965. The repression of revolutionary aspects of the black struggle in the 1960s and 70s resulted in the creation of the New Jim Crow. The new system invented the ideology of color blindness, and it perpetuated the underdevelopment and victimization of the African-American masses. Consequently, racial discrimination, poverty, and police brutality have resulted in a disproportionate black prison population. Currently, African-Americans represent only 12% of the U.S. population, but 33% of its prison population. Many leaders and activists refer to this prison pipeline system for black Americans as modern-day slavery. In addition, the killing of blacks by police officers has continued unabated. Blacks are furious and frustrated over the killings of Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile, Breonna Taylor, Aubrey Miller, and many others. Recently, the public lynching of George Floyd by a white police officer and his three colleagues became a global event. On May 25th, 2020, when a convenience store clerk called 911 to inform four Minneapolis police officers that George Floyd had bought cigarettes with a counterfeit $20 bill, the officers overpowered and brought him under their control with the support of three other officers. Derek Chauvin, a white police officer, put and kept his knee on the victim's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, rendering him unconscious and unable to breathe. He died under Chauvin's knee. This lynching took place while the public was videotaping and watching what happened. Across the world, Floyd's murder ignited protests in which diverse peoples, including whites, demanded police reform and racial equality. Similarly, the assassination of the famous Omuro singer and activist Hundessy on 29 June triggered the Omuro wide civil unrest that involved killings. Hamid's government used brutal force, killing many and imprisoning thousands, and blocked the internet to support the popular uprising of the Oromo diaspora in Europe and North America has also been protesting for many weeks, demanding justice for Hachatlilu and for the imprisoned Omuro political prisoners all over Oromia. Okay. Okay, I'm gonna give a little short take on this right here. His remarks resemble how many Africans and others view foundational black Americans in this country when they come here. They make these blanket judgments that shouldn't be given a pass or shouldn't be forgiven for the simple fact they have enough information to educate themselves not to make stupid remarks like this. Now, there are some of our, I wouldn't necessarily say leaders, but personalities on Facebook are pushing for what they call it, you know, Africans and Americans in the diaspora to be together. I think it's Pan-Africanism, that's the word. Now, giving foundational Black American struggle in this country, which I just went over the great majority of it in speech, it's pretty hard for us to want to reunite with the rest of Africa when there is very, I'm not going to say it's not needed, because it is needed. Because when you look at other groups that come to this country, they have a whole country backing them. And they aren't treated as we are treated, because they have a whole country to stand up for them. They have embassies in the United States, and we have embassies in some of their countries. So, say for instance, let's take Chinese for instance. They come over here as diplomats, you know, some of them come here, you know, as on visas and stuff like that. But let's say for instance, they, Chauvin and them other three police officers were, you know, brutalized a Chinese immigrant or citizen or whatever, and stood on their neck for almost 9 minutes until they passed out and fucking died. What do you think would happen? The Chinese government will be so far up President Biden's ass, they'll know his appetite. That's the difference. So Pan-Africanism is needed, because if you make Africa stronger, then, you know, they could be strong enough to stand up, you know, and apply pressure, you know, in our favor here. But the sad part about it is that is, to me, is at least 100 years away. But by Pan-Africanism being necessary and needed, but it's so far, the achievement is so far in the distance, it doesn't help. When you have a whole Ethiopian prime minister that makes these type of asinine and stupid remarks, you know, it pisses us off. It pisses us off as a foundational Black Americans for the simple reason, when you look at history, we advocated for them to be able to come to this country. But see, and I'm going to keep it real, and some of these Africans, they come to America with their asses on their backs. And I'm gonna fucking keep it real. They come over here with that same type of sentiment, you know, but they come over here thinking they're better than us, because this is, you know, evidently it's our fault that we haven't achieved freedom in America, the America that we built during when we was in bondage, you know. So they come over here. First of all, they treat it differently. They have a whole country behind them, you know, with this same sentiment. So, but then on the other hand, they talk about us being poor. African Americans, we're the 9th largest economy in the world. We are not poor. There's a segment of poor people in every group in America, but us suffering the type of poverty that these Ethiopians suffer before they come here, we don't see that type of poverty. Even on public assistance, on food stamps or welfare, we don't see that type of poverty. You know what I'm saying? They come over here leaving their shacks and shanty towns to come to America to tell us that we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. You know, they come over here, you know, thumbing their nose at us, when if it weren't for us, their asses wouldn't be in this country. You know, and as of recent, They're trying to make sure that less Africans or less dark-skinned people get to migrate to America anyway. So it would be, you know, to benefit Pan-Africanism, it would be to a lot of these other countries in Africa, you know, for their leaders not to piss us the fuck off. You know, it doesn't do us any good and it doesn't do them any good. But at the same time, we right now, we're trying to ride for ourselves. Now, I know there are people like Dr. Umar that say Pan-African or perish. Yeah, I do believe that. But at the same time, these attitudes, they need to do their fucking homework before they come over here. Now, I'm not going to say that that's all of them, but you have a whole prime minister from Ethiopia making that type of remarks and in front of people, and they giggling and laughing and shit. And they, when their asses go back home, they going home to a damn cave. They need to shut the hell up. You know what I'm saying? They need to come over here and put some fucking respect on our name. That's what they need to do. You know what I'm saying? I'm keeping it real. I talk to foreigners, you know, and the great deal of foreign people I talk to, they may feel that way, but they don't say it. And then, you know, I have good conversations with people from Africa and Ethiopia, you know, recently. But when I first moved to Atlanta, you know, and I was lived in the downtown area, you know, like just near Jesse Hill Jr. and Auburn Avenue. And I would go into some of these places and I would have conversations with them. I don't know how they would start, but I would have to set them straight because I know my history and I know theirs too. Yeah. So my thing would be, okay, we caught hell. We built this country and been catching hell ever since. But it's not like we're leaving to go somewhere else because of it. Not in droves. We don't leave America and migrate to other countries the way Africans come to America. Now it's beginning to, black people are beginning to visit the continent of the motherland more and, you know, repatriate, you know, at maybe a higher rate than ever before, you know, because of obvious reasons. But we haven't made the decision to leave our country to go somewhere else because it was just so bad and we just didn't want to stay and fight and stick it out. But you got these other, you got Africans and Ethiopians, they come to America, thumbing their nose at us, but they decided to cut and run, including the Haitians. Oh, y'all cutting and running, but y'all not gonna stay and fight and, you know, to build y'all country up to where it should be to hold you. See what I'm saying? So you can't come over here with that sentiment. And it really, his remarks pissed me off because in modern times, he made these remarks in 2019. And in modern times, you can't do some, it's not, that bullshit about America's still in poverty, casting a blanket on all black Americans as being in poverty because we still dwell on our history to the point where we can't move forward. That's a bunch of bullshit. Now, the Jews, they went through what they went through. But for him to say that they don't reflect on their history, they do, because they have museums. They make movies like we make movies, and they say never again. See, you know your history, so you won't be doomed to repeat it. Now they have museums, and they get reparations from their from the people that terrorized them. They get monies from them. We don't. But to say that singing "We Shall Overcome" and observing our assassinated leaders, birthdays and the fact that they were assassinated, and not being able to move forward, like we still living in poverty, that is, he need to get that, you know, it's unconscionable. His remarks is like, what? And we don't even know a Shaq. No. And then it's sad because, you know, when he spoke those words to people that our minds are impressionable, and at the same time, instead of him holding himself and his country responsible for not making Ethiopia what it should be, so Ethiopian citizens don't have to sneak out and come to America, you know, he need to check himself. So that's all I have to say about that. This is going to be an end to my first episode of 2020. And I'm going to end this by saying Happy New Year. Let's do better in the new year. Please, let's do better in every way imaginable as a people. Let's do better. I'll see you guys next time God leaves his footprints in the sky. And again, love each other. I'll holler at y'all again soon when I make the second episode for my fourth season of Listen to L Boogie. Peace.